sounds like the 1960s version of The Shades of Grey.
Ooh.
So controversial.
I don't think it's as much fun, though. Hello, everyone. It's the Two Boomer Babes.
We talked to a doctor who thought a near-death experience was a fantasy. That is, until he had one.
Who knew the publication of a dictionary could set off a firestorm? You'll hear a bizarre tale.
You use forks, knives, spoons, and plates every day. But did you ever wonder how they came to be? A food historian talks culinary inventions.
Plus, an alternative living arrangement for the elderly. A high-tech cottage in our own backyard. While thousands of people have had near-death experiences, known as NDEs, scientists maintain that while they may seem real, these occurrences are fantasies produced when a brain is under extreme stress.
That's what renowned neurosurgeon Dr. Evan Alexander believed. Throughout his 25-year career, he could never reconcile a belief in heaven, God, or the soul. But all that changed dramatically when his brain was viciously attacked by a rare illness, and he had his own near-death experience.
Dr. Alexander joins us on the phone from the beautiful mountains of Virginia. It's a pleasure to have you join us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Dr. Alexander, what happened that fateful morning?
It was like being struck by a freight train. I woke up at 4:30 in the morning, had severe back pain, could barely get out of bed, but thought a warm bath would help, then severe headache, and I was already too far gone to know what was going on. And my last words were something like, don't call 911. You know, it's just muscle spasm. That's about the last thing I know. And then I spent the next 7 days deep in coma after having a grand mal seizure.
Oh, and it was really severe. I mean, it was critical. You basically only had a 3% chance of survival, correct?
Right. Well, when I got to the emergency room, I was already in coma and still seizing. And in fact, they recognized I was very ill, put me on a ventilator right away. And my chance of survival at the beginning in the ER was only about 10%. And by the end of the week, not responding to antibiotics, it was down to about 2% chance survival and no chance of neurologic recovery.
Well, here's where I start really getting chills. You describe that the place you went to was, and I quote, real in a way that makes the life we're living here and now completely dreamlike by comparison.
Oh, it was, well, it all started as a kind of an underground course monotonous realm, but then I was rescued from that by this beautiful spinning white light with fine gold and white filaments. And a lovely, perfect musical melody. And as it came closer to me, it opened up as a rip in the fabric into this lovely, verdant valley. Flowers blossoming, buds opening, even as we went by. I had no body awareness, but was a speck on a butterfly wing, brilliant colors beyond the rainbow, and millions of other butterflies all looping, swirling down into the greenery below as the flowers would blossom and bloom. What I called villagers or souls dancing below us, waterfalls, and this summer breeze that was an awareness of the divine, and then angelic choirs up above that were beyond description of these swooping orbs of light and crescendo after crescendo, absolutely lovely, with a beautiful girl beside me on the butterfly wing. And from there, we went outside of this universe, outside of higher dimensional space and time, in the dwelling place of the divine, all-powerful creator and this brilliant orb of light to teach me lessons. But I was told I wasn't there to stay, but we'd be going back.
So you had some awareness that you were in a different place, that you were not on Earth anymore?
Very much. And in fact, the meningitis had done a tremendous job destroying my neocortex, the outer part of the brain, that's the part that makes us human, and had completely deleted all of my memories of my life, my personality, any knowledge of humans on Earth. All that was gone when I was in this realm, and that was very helpful. It kind of made my near-death experience the exception that proves the rule.
Well, you actually said it was the perfect storm for this type of experience, correct?
Well, it was a perfect storm of all just to go through this experience with a very rare bacterial meningitis, less than 1 in 10 million, usually occurs in newborns, E. coli meningitis. Then to have such an extraordinary journey all at a time when I should have had no experience at all, because my brain was incapable of performing experience. And that was the part that was so shocking when I came back, was how in the world to explain that very rich experience when I should have had no experience at all. Meningitis was a gift in that sense, because I really should have experienced nothing, and yet I wrote it all down initially before I read anything about near-death literature, and it was 20,000 words of just describing my experience in coma. And I had to understand where that came from. It was ultra real, too real to be real.
So would you describe that the place you were at, would you use the word heaven?
Well, I think what my experience very clearly brings out is that our consciousness is actually freed up and much richer when it's freed from the brain. And in fact, that when our brain and body dies, when the physical brain and body die, that actually liberates our conscious awareness to a much higher level of existence. And of course, on my journey, I saw that that was into the dwelling place of the divine, infinitely knowing, infinitely powerful, and unconditionally loving creator of all. And that, I think, by many people's definition, would be what we call heaven, even though it not jive exactly with everybody's individual view of heaven. The more powerful aspect of my story is that it goes a long way towards proving that there's a fundamental existence out there, that these near-death experiences and other spiritual journeys bring back a knowing of something that's very real. Don't dismiss it as a trick of the brain.
This is the Two Boomer Babes, and we're speaking with neurosurgeon Dr. Evan Alexander, who has written a gripping memoir about his own near-death experience. The book is called Proof of Heaven, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Afterlife. Dr. Alexander, so you were describing your experiences. What about God? Did you experience what you would say is God?
Absolutely. In fact, the biggest gift from this journey was knowing that an all-loving, all-powerful God is at the core of all that exists. And that was first made clear to me when I was in that gateway in the beautiful valley on the butterfly wing with a lovely girl who gave me messages of such peace and comfort. You are loved, cherished, dearly forever. You have nothing to fear, and there's nothing you can do wrong in this realm. That is, in the spiritual realm, nothing I could do wrong. Very comforting, and then a warm breeze that blew through, which was my coming to know the presence of that all-powerful divine and unconditional love of God. And then outside of this universe, into the core, infinite inky blackness filled with light by this orb brighter than a million stars right next to me, and these lessons that I was taught out in that core. And that all-loving God was all throughout that core, outside of the higher dimensional multiverse, outside of all time. The first 2 months after I came back, I would not even use the word God in my writings, because God to me was, the word was a trivial human word that greatly diminished the power and awe that I felt in the presence of that all-powerful deity. But it's by everybody's definition what people would call God or Allah or Brahman, whatever the word is for that all-powerful, loving creator at the source.
Well, Dr. Alexandra, how has this experience changed your life on a daily basis? I mean, do you have more of a carpe diem kind of attitude?
Well, it's changed my life entirely. I mean, coming away, I realized several months after this journey that it was very strong proof that our soul is eternal, that our soul or spirit is actually liberated to a much higher state of awareness after being freed up from the brain and body. And that's something that a lot of us can come to know through centering prayer and deep meditation, because deep in our consciousness is all of that knowing that I saw on my journey. And it's totally changed the way I am as a healer. I now see each and every one of us, myself, family, friends, patients, as physical, mental, emotional, spiritual, and divine through all levels. I also see how our lives are interlinked through multiple lives and across with our soulmates across this life and other lives. That has everything to do with our purpose for existence and the existence of the whole universe, and that is manifesting that unconditional love from the Creator with that compassion and forgiveness that is all about ascendancy of our souls in that outer realm.
And Doctor, you have mentioned a couple of times about this beautiful woman, a guardian angel, whatever you want to refer to her as, on your journey. Can you tell us briefly, I know it's quite a story, but who you finally determined that she was?
Well, it to me it was a big mystery, because I came back from my coma and I had not, you know, I wrote the whole thing down, like I said, 20,000 words over 6 weeks. Then I started reading the near-death literature, and I was shocked by the similarities of my story with so many others, the ultra-reality. There was so much to it, and not just that, but all the afterlife literature. And I was mystified because my father was not there. He had passed over 4 years before my coma, and he was nowhere to be found, and yet this beautiful girl on the butterfly wing was there multiple times. Every time I passed through that gateway on the way outside the universe, there was this beautiful girl. I could remember her face so clearly, I knew I had never met her in my life. And it was shocking. Who in the world could that be? Because I came to realize that my journey was a powerful, authentic spiritual journey, yet why would they play such tricks on me that my father wasn't there and this beautiful girl I'd never met was there? 4 months after my coma is when it all came together. This is a spoiler alert for anyone reading the book, because this is how it all comes together in the book, too. I was adopted and had kind of given up on finding my birth mother in my 20s. But then in the year 2000, my son was doing a project in family genealogy, and he wanted to know about birth family. I reached out again to the children's home and found that, in fact, my birth parents had gotten married. That was a huge shock. Also found they had 3 kids, that my youngest sister had died 2 years earlier in 1998, and that it was not a good time to come back in their lives. That rejection in 2000 squashed any hope in a loving God or prayer for 8 years until my coma. And then in my coma, I had this incredible experience, and I had met my birth family a year before coma, and my sister had promised to send a picture of that departed birth sister named Betsy. And 4 months after coma, I finally got that picture, and it was at a time when I read a Elizabeth Kubler-Ross story that talked about a girl and her experience. And when I saw that picture, I realized, oh, my gosh.
Wow, that's quite a story.
Who it was, and it was so stunning, I couldn't even stand up for 30 minutes.
Wow. Well, finally, Dr. Alexander, after all this, do you have any shadow of a doubt that this really happened and was not a result of some trauma to the brain, and that there's some, maybe there's still some scientific explanation for what you experienced?
There's no materialistic explanation within the brain for what I experienced. It truly happened. It was not a hallucination or a dream. And that final twist and proof with my birth sister, who I never met and had not seen, being the one who was there on my journey, showed me very clearly the reality of this whole message. The fact that I had severe meningitis, there's no way this happened in my brain, and I rule that out in the book just through all the skeptical theories. I was my own worst skeptic trying to analyze this. So I went through everything trying to explain it based in the brain, and there's no brain-based explanation.
Dr. Evan Alexander, neurosurgeon and author of Proof of Heaven, thank you so much for sharing this amazing story with the Two Boomer Babes.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it, and look forward to talking to you again sometime.
Up next, who knew that a dictionary could create such a ruckus? Stay tuned for the story of Ain't.
Support comes from Accent on Travel, Rehoboth Beach, with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Let's go back to the early 1960s. Think Cuban Missile Crisis, the construction of the Berlin Wall, a growing civil rights movement, not to mention the sexual revolution and the wide availability of the pill. Amidst this upheaval, who knew that the publication of a mere dictionary could ignite a firestorm and set off a panic?
In the story of Ain't, America, Its Language, and the Most Controversial Dictionary Ever Published, David Skinner tells the truth is stranger than fiction story of the publication of Webster's Third Dictionary. Some compared it to the end of civilization, and today he tells us why. David Skinner joins us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Delighted to have you on the show, David.
Thanks for having me.
What was it about the publication of this dictionary, Webster's Third, that was so controversial?
Well, at first it should be said that people have absurdly strong feelings about language. We all do. We have irrationally strong opinions about other people's usage. But this was a new and very different dictionary. It was, in the words of its critics, a permissive dictionary. It took a kind of scientific, clinical approach to the language, not passing judgment where older dictionaries had freely offered their opinions on what was good English and what was not. This tried to be less judgmental about the language, and it tried to report how the language was actually used, not how it should be used. And so it described the language in a kind of non-judgmental way, when a lot of people who buy dictionaries and use dictionaries actually go to dictionaries for, you know, forthright advice on how to use words. They're looking for the right answer, not just all the answers that are out there at any given moment in time.
Well, it's one of our Bibles, isn't it, Barbara?
Right.
Let's talk about some of the new words that were included. Give us some examples.
The press release, you know, bragged of words like A-bomb, astronaut, beatnik, den mother, fringe benefit, satellite, solar house, wage, dividend, zen, a lot of military and technical terms, but also a lot of terms from the popular culture. You see in that list some terms that Jack Kerouac used and the beatniks used. But there are a whole host of 1950s and World War II terms that come into the dictionary in 1961.
And even something so simple like den mother.
Exactly.
I mean, who would think that was a new word? You know, hasn't the Boy Scouts have been around forever?
Exactly. And the word cool. I mean, it's a whole different meaning in the 60s as it was in the 30s, right?
Yeah, cool is one of those words to which they add a new sense. They add one, you know, more definition, which says the latest in approved technique. And they give the verbal illustration of a cool actor or a cool musician. But this is just 2 years after Miles Davis brings out his pioneering album, Birth of the Cool. And you can see in this moment a whole new usage for cool that is, well, huge in our language today.
And then there was also a major brouhaha, which I guess that wouldn't have been in the Webster Second, over the inclusion of the word ain't. Now, what was that all about?
Well, it was about a few things, but the first thing it's about is a press release. When they brought out this dictionary, they looked to a very sort of modern technique for announcing and promoting their book. They wanted to get as many mentions in the newspapers as possible, so they hired a PR firm. And the PR firm focused on the usage note for the entry for the word ain't. And they very selectively quoted it, and the press release said, ain't, according to Webster's, is used orally in most parts of the U.S. by cultivated speakers. I mean, this is very funny. I mean, for generations, students have been told, use ain't. They've been told things, you know, absurdities like ain't is not a word. And suddenly Webster's, the greatest brand in American dictionaries, the authority, is saying ain't is cultivated? It was so strange. It was so bizarre. It was also wrong, as it happens. The dictionary actually had a much more balanced usage note. If you read it in full, it said that ain't was disapproved by many and more common in less educated speech. And as it, you know, discussed cultivated people using the word ain't, it really focused on the first person, you know, people who say, I'm an American, ain't I? A very colloquial, informal usage that was... But suddenly the dictionary seemed to be saying, according to the press release, that it was high English, that it was, you know, proper English, that it was, you know.
So the ladies were getting their smelling salts out, I'm sure.
Oh, probably. Well, tell us about Philip Gove, the editor of Webster's Third. Why did he think the beloved Webster's Second, which was published in 1934, needed to be overhauled?
Oh, well, for so many reasons. One was just that it was so big. That dictionary weighed 17 pounds.
Wow.
If you hold your two hands together, it's huge. It's like 8 inches wide. It's enormous. it almost represents the physical limits of an actual single-volume book. They couldn't figure out a way to add more pages to that book to update the vocabulary and still sell it. They'd have to break it into two volumes, and they didn't want to do that. So they wanted to make a one-volume dictionary. Also, that dictionary, Webster's Second, it wanted to be encyclopedic. It wanted to represent all that was worth knowing. You know, it had all the names of characters in books by Charles Dickens and plays of Shakespeare, all the figures in the Bible, all the wars, treaties, countries, princes, princesses, kings, dukes, et cetera, throughout history. It was an incredible smorgasbord of literary and historical culture. Also, it was a very puritanical dictionary. It had it had a sort of kind of old boys take on a lot of issues in the culture that it just wasn't so nice.
Well, I could just imagine that's the thing that you would have in your living room on a pedestal and then have this great big book displayed.
When we come back, more with David Skinner, author of The Story of Ain't, America, Its Language, and the Most Controversial Dictionary Ever Published. Stay with us.
Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6 I make his breakfast. Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6 I make his breakfast. At 7 I shower. Every day I wake up.
For those caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community to help us better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
This is Barb and Kathy, the Two Boomer Babes. We're continuing our conversation with David Skinner about the baffling story behind the publication of Webster's Third Dictionary and the uproar it created. So, David, we were talking about the difference really between the third edition and the second edition, the beloved second edition. Basically, the third edition had more cultural pop references, like to movies, to sports figures, that were basically considered too lowbrow for the second. Is that correct?
That is correct. Philip Gove, the editor of Webster's Third, wanted his definers to use contemporary American English. And so he wrote out instructions for them to, you know, freely use current authors, but also anything that might appear in a newspaper or a magazine. And this led to some very lowbrow authorities on the language being quoted, like Mickey Spillane or Betty Grable or just characters like that, baseball players.
Left out Babe Ruth. I couldn't believe that. That was too lowbrow?
Well, Webster's Second left out Babe Ruth,
right?
Which was funny because Webster's Second had this very highbrow view of what was really culture. And baseball wasn't really culture. You know, Babe Ruth had, I think, won, you know, 7 pennants at this time by 1934 and set the home run record, but somehow he didn't rate mention in a great American dictionary. But by 1961, they had gotten past that. In fact, they took a very different view of the culture and of their sort of position as arbiters of the culture.
The second also made real judgments, too, didn't they, about words? If something was vulgar or they saw it as vulgar, it was captured in the dictionary.
Well, yeah, if you looked at the definition for ain't in Webster's Second, it says vulgar, illiterate. But also other things are vulgar. If you look up the word masturbation in Webster's Second, you get this very sort of sermon-like definition. The entire definition reads, onanism, semicolon, self-pollution.
You will go blind.
If I had a fourth edition, I'd put it in there.
Well, David, did all this uproar help or hurt sales? I mean, I would think people would buy just to see what the fuss was all about.
They did. In 1961, Webster's Third did gangbuster business. They went back for a second printing within just a couple of months of the first release. Apparently, they had well underestimated how many copies they were going to sell. It made a lot of money for the company. It did very, very well. Also, there was no real competitor. I'm sorry, for Webster's Third at this time, and it, you know, Merriam really kind of owned the business, had a monopoly on the unabridged dictionary business. No one else really has the files or the history to be able to produce so fine and complete a product as Merriam and Company.
It sounds like the 1960s version of The Shades of Grey.
Ooh.
So controversial.
I don't think it's as much fun, though. Well, I don't know about you, but I have this great big fat dictionary collecting dust in my bookshelves. Because, of course, now we check everything on the computer. What's to become of the physical dictionary?
I think there will always be at least desktop dictionaries and pocket dictionaries. Those sell a great number of copies and remain quite profitable. Also, there's a huge business these days in learner's dictionaries. There's so many people learning English around the world that there's a pretty brisk market in that kind of dictionary. As for the big, fat, oversized, unabridged dictionary, its days do seem to be numbered. Merriam has announced that it's working on Webster's fourth, but there's no plans to print it yet. They're going to put it up online serially as they accumulate definitions and complete individual letters.
Boy, how times change.
Hey, maybe Two Boomer Babes will be in the dictionary.
Oh, I'm sure it will be. Well, real quick, we just have a few seconds. What is it about language that triggers such a visceral response? I mean, we're not talking politics or maligning someone's mom.
I think we know that we judge each other so much by our words, and that our words, in a lot of ways, represent our highest aspirations for ourselves. The person I want to be is the person I'm trying to describe in the words I use. And in other people's words, I'm getting a reflection of the world at large. And so my opinion of their language in many ways reflects my opinions of the world and whether or not, the culture is in a good state, the country's in a good state, whether the country's on the right track, the economy's on the right track. So it represents a lot.
Well, David Skinner, author of The Story of Ain't, thanks so much for sharing this pretty incredible story with the Two Boomer Babes.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me in.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Support comes from Accent on Travel, Rehoboth Beach, with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154. Up next, the hidden history of our culinary tools. How did the fork and food processors come to be? Stay with us and find out.
If you love to cook, or to eat for that matter, then your choice of kitchen tools is very important. Since the Stone Age, we humans have become obsessed with inventing better ways to prepare meals and to feed ourselves. Today, technology and gadgets have transformed our home kitchens into stainless steel laboratories, housing everything from the latest computerized refrigerator and wine coolers to dishwashers that are so advanced they practically take on human characteristics.
Food writer and historian Bea Wilson unveils in her new book, Consider the Fork, how the history of food is the history of kitchen technology. She says the gadgets we use in our kitchen affect the foods we prepare and consume. Bea joins us from Cambridge, England. Terrific to have you on the show, Bea.
Thank you so much for having me.
What do you consider to be the single greatest leap in kitchen technology?
I think, although it happened a long time ago, the invention of pottery is one of those things that we don't think about. We all have pots and pans. We take them for granted in our kitchens. But if you imagine what it would have been like to try and cook without pots, it's a huge leap forward. And although it happened 10,000 years ago, in terms of the great sweep of human history, that's quite a short time because people have been cooking with fire for either 1 million or 2 million years, depending on which anthropologist you speak to. And just being able to have a pot, which meant that for the first time you could combine flavors, you could cook many ingredients which simply wouldn't have been possible to cook in a roasting sort of fire. And I think so many of us still feel a kind of affection towards our pots and pans today. I mean, I certainly know I couldn't cook a meal without them. So I think although that sounds really obvious and basic, that to me is probably the single greatest invention of all time, if you make an exception for fire. Looking at more recent ones, another one that we sort of don't give enough credit to is the gas oven. around 100 or a little bit more years ago, and what a difference that would have made to the lives of so many women, where previously the whole of human existence, more or less, had been dominated by the need to get a fire going, keep it going, clean the fire, and just the business of cooking was essentially the art of fire management. And then suddenly you have gas ovens, and at a stroke you can just switch this thing on and off and control fire and not have all the associated pollution and disease that went along with open fire. So I think that's another big one. But then if I think of the technologies that just make cooking more fun, it might be something like a vegetable peeler, which I would argue that vegetable peelers have only really got good in about the past 10 or 20 years. So that's very recent.
Well, funny you should say that, because I absolutely love my vegetable peeler, and I hate to cook. But there's something about those new ergonomic handles that actually make it fun to peel potatoes.
It's really comfortable. It's satisfying. You get it done. They're efficient, aren't they?
Right.
And you just watch this pile of beautiful vegetables emerging, almost as if you're not doing it, because it's so easy.
Right. Well, it was also fascinating to read about the importance of knives and how they really affect how we cook. And I guess this may be why we see so many of those top chefs, you know, with a gazillion knives.
Absolutely. If you ask a chef what their favorite gadget is, 9 times out of 10, they will say a knife. And as if it's, what else would it be? I mean, that's the process of producing a meal starts with knife work before you're even considering the question of heat. And I find it very interesting how different cuisines approach the question of knives in completely different ways. So if you look at the difference between Chinese cuisine, for example, versus Western cuisine, you could talk about different flavors and how in China they use scallions and ginger and garlic, whereas in France they might use butter and lemon juice. But there are also different cuisines of knives. So a Chinese cook can do everything that he or she wants to do using a single cleaver-shaped instrument, the two, whether they are mincing tiny pieces of ginger or hacking away at a chicken. Whereas a French-trained chef, or by extension chefs in the States or the rest of or Europe, need many, many different specialist knives, ranging from kind of chestnut peelers to ham slicers to boners to carvers.
Well, B, I have to tell you, after 30 years of marriage, I finally got myself some good knives, but I don't have any idea what to use them for. I have about a set of 10 gleaming knives, but I don't know.
I use the same one all the time.
As
a home cook, you probably don't need 100 specialist different knives for different jobs, because I think we're creatures of habit in the kitchen, aren't we? I mean, I know I just always reach for my favorite knife each time, whatever I'm doing, whether it's exactly the right knife or not. You just have one that feels right in your hand and you know it's reasonably sharp, and that's the one you go for. And it's interesting psychologically. I think some people are small knife cooks and other people are large knife cooks. It depends what makes you feel safer.
I thought a fascinating tidbit of information was about canned foods that were first invented in 1812. However, it wasn't until 50 years later that the can opener was invented. So opening the can, was that another use for the knife?
People would, I mean, the thing about canned food, I mean, it is extraordinary to think of the time lag. We assume that kind of technologies all proceed in this kind of neat form. And actually, yeah, that seems so basic, doesn't it, that you think you'd invent canned food and you'd invent the can opener at the same time. Early canned food was almost exclusively used by armies and navies. So it was probably being opened by giant bayonets. And some of the cans would come with an instruction saying, open with a hammer and chisel, which is quite mind-boggling.
I bet they got lots of scratches and
cuts
on that thing.
It'd be vicious. And if you think what bad cuts you could get, even just from a kind of bad can opener of the kind that were readily available about 20 years ago. I remember growing up with quite vicious can openers that would leave jagged edges. Whereas again, a bit like with ergonomic peelers, can openers are pretty good now.
This is the Two Boomer Babes, and we are chatting with food writer and historian Bea Wilson about the ever-evolving technology of kitchen tools and equipment. Her book is called Consider the Fork. Well, Bea, we know, speaking of fork, that I didn't realize this until I read your book, that it's a relatively new invention and was actually the butt of jokes when it first appeared. I mean, it's such an all-around utensil. What was the problem with the fork?
People saw it as being a bit weird. They saw it as being even effeminate to be eating using a fork. And if you think about it, there is something kind of counterintuitive about putting metal prongs into your mouth along with food. And For centuries, people had managed just fine using a sharp knife, which was in those days a personal object. People carried their own knives with them, women as well as men. And you'd no more think of eating with a stranger's knife than you would nowadays brush your teeth with a stranger's toothbrush. It was something you carried around with you, brought out whenever it was mealtimes. And they would manage with just fingers and a knife and spoons if you were eating something like a kind of stew-like, soup-like thing. And people thought that was fine. And it was only the Italians who used forks for many centuries, the reason being pasta. Because if you think about it, to eat long strands of slippery noodles, a prong-like instrument is a really useful thing. Whereas for a long, long time, yeah, people thought forks were weird. And it's very strange because, I mean, now, obviously, the fork is probably the most universal utensil. It's used for every kind of meal, from a fast food meal where it might be a plastic fork or even a spork, to a fancy kind of Michelin-starred restaurant meal. But it took centuries for it to be accepted and for people to stop making the fork jokes.
Well, and we also have to mention the spoon. We can't leave the spoon out. And that fabulous French chef, Julia Child, used her spoons to shape her ganelles, which were a very, very tricky dish to make, which still are. I actually even tried it one time.
Mm,
it was a disaster.
It is tricky, isn't it?
Very
yeah.
tricky. But in a roundabout way, didn't it this kind of inspire the revolutionary device that we all know now as the Cuisinart?
Yeah, and the Cuisinart is, I think, an amazing invention because I think, and there are lots of kitchen inventions which have enabled us to do something that we're already doing a bit easier, whereas the Cuisinart arguably just transformed people's entire aspirations in the kitchen. It turned them into different kinds of cooks. There was suddenly a possibility that instead of being the sort of drudgery that cooking had been for so many of our grandmothers' generations, it could be something fun. You could play because you could take this machine where you could make quenelles, the press of a button, it would take a couple of seconds rather than the hours of pounding and sieving it might have taken before. And you could be making something really fun and delicious. And I think from descriptions of the first cookware shop owners who were describing how the kind of ways in which the customers who came and bought a Cuisinart, they then came back and bought many, many more different utensils. It had turned them on to the whole process of ambitious cooking.
Okay, I can't take it anymore. What's a quenelle? Real quickly.
Oh, Barbara.
Now they're easy to make. People don't bother making them anymore. They are
you can tell I'm such a cook.
They're a kind of very delicate dumpling made usually from chicken or sometimes from white fish, which is combined with egg white and cream and various other seasonings and is then, as you say, formed ever so carefully between two spoons to produce this kind of oval-like shape, and then they're poached. But as Julia Child herself says, they often collapse, and then you just have to pretend you were trying to make mousse or something instead.
Well, I guess my next question would be is where can you buy them? But anyway, we'll talk about that later. Well, Bea, if you could only have one thing in your kitchen, what would that be?
Oh, I couldn't choose just one. But I think the one thing that you do see in every kitchen, even today, even though it goes back such a long time, is the wooden spoon. I couldn't cook without my wooden spoon, even though it's such a basic object, but I feel fond of it. And I also would argue that nothing really does the job of a wooden spoon as well as it does.
Well, you know, and I think wooden spoons evoke such memories because I know I have my mom's wooden spoon, and I just love it. I love it. I wouldn't throw it away for anything.
Yeah, it does remind you, doesn't it, of those childhood memories of making cakes together and stirring and smelling good smells and knowing that supper was going to be on the table soon.
Well, my wooden spoon reminds me of burning dinner, Bea, because mine is all black at the edge.
Well, I like spoons like that. They develop character, don't they, when they get those kind of burnt spots.
Well, I think one of my favorite tools, again, I inherited from my grandmother, is the egg cooker.
One of those egg poachers.
Yes.
Don't you just put eggs in a pot and boil them?
Barbara, you're so passe.
You don't see those much anymore, do you? I remember that with the four little poaching things.
Yes, and they make the perfect egg.
And then you'd get the perfect little dome when you turned it out. And, yeah,
absolutely.
I'm feeling very nostalgic now. I don't know what happened to our egg cooker in our family.
Oh, well, I have to send you one.
Yeah, start a revival.
Bea Wilson, food historian and author of Consider the Fork, thanks so much for being with us. Our kitchens will never be the same.
Up next, alternative living arrangements for our elderly parents and in our own backyard.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Support comes from Accent on Travel Rehoboth Beach with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. At 7 a.m., I shower. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. At 7 a.m., I shower. I start laundry at 8. At 10, we go for a walk. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m.
For those dealing with the daily struggles of caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community with experts and other caregivers for advice, tips, and support. Together, let's help each other better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
This is the news. This morning, we are saluting the 2.2 million women who have joined in the war effort. They now make up 37% of the workforce, changing their role forever.
The prestigious Harvard Medical School is breaking ground today, opening its doors to new female applicants.
Today, little girls all over the world look to the sky, where the first woman is now in space.
Military stereotypes are challenged today with the trailblazing promotion of a U.S. female officer to four-star general. It was just announced that the vast majority of last year's doctorate degrees were earned by women.
We've come so far, but our news is changing for the worse. More women die from heart disease and stroke than men, even though it can be prevented. Make a change at GoRedForWomen.org today. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the American Heart Association's Go Red for Women.
Who might you save?
Your mother, your father, your husband, uncle, aunt, son.
Learn FAST, F-A-S-T, the sudden signs of a stroke, and you could save...
Your friend, your best friend, teacher, boss, coach.
F, face drooping. A, arm weakness. S, speech difficulty. T, time to call 911. F-A-S-T, face, arm, speech, time. That's F, face drooping, A, arm weakness, S, speech difficulty, T, time to call 911. The sooner they get to the hospital, the sooner they'll get treatment, and that can make a remarkable difference in the recovery of...
Your neighbor, the waiter, a fellow shopper, a total stranger, grandmother, grandfather.
So learn FAST, the sudden signs of a stroke, then pass it on, because you never know who might save you.
Your wife, your colleague, teammate... Mother.
Spot a stroke fast. Visit strokeassociation.org. Brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.
Many boomers agonize over the best way to care for our aging relatives and shudder at the thought of putting them in a nursing home. Ken Dupin, CEO of Med Cottage, has come up with a high-tech alternative. It balances an elderly person's need for independence and special care. Ken joins us on the phone from Blacksburg, Virginia, to shoot the breeze with the babes. Great to have you on the show, Ken.
Well, it's good to be with the babes, too.
Ken, describe the Med Cottage, which we understand is fondly referred to as a granny pad.
It is, affectionately, and that's its nickname. But it's a small dwelling that's portable and that it's placed on a caregiver's property. It enables a family to participate in the care of an aging loved one. And one of the things that we discovered in our research, and as we age, we desire to be close to our family. And one of our fears is that we will be alienated or isolated at this stage in our life. And so this was our way of addressing that.
Tell us, how does it get in the backyard? Is it one of those easy to assemble?
It comes fully manufactured, and then it's placed in your backyard by a contractor, and it
that's on what we call portable piers so that it can be removed later when it's no longer needed. It's a complete dwelling with its own air conditioning and heating system, and it has many different types of technology that assist people that would need this stage in their life.
Ken, how big are we talking about? Is it like the size of a shed?
We have two models size-wise. One of them is 300 square feet, and it is for one person. And we have another model now that we just came out with that is 600 square feet, and it would be for two people or a person that was receiving care and a caregiver. So those are the two sizes that we have.
Okay. Wow, that's small-time living.
Yeah. And then you were talking about a lot of the smart devices which can be put in the cottage, including a really cool toilet that does more than just flush. So do tell.
One of the things that we endeavored to do was address the three primary reasons that we lose our independence. And the first one is medication. So it has an electronic med dispenser in it so that it will remind you and talk to you about taking it. And if you don't, then it will signal the caregiver that you did not retrieve your medicine. And we also have a floor in it that is made by Boeing that has a force reduction of about 38% so that if you do fall, that it's not catastrophic in the sense of breaking bones and that kind of thing. And the other thing it has is a lift system in it with a track so that the caregiver can keep you mobile if you're not able to do that anymore. And so those were the three primary things that we addressed initially. Now, from there, it has grown technology-wise, and really and truly a doctor could do a remote house call on the medical technology in it, and they could do that in real time now.
Ken, how much does one of these little puppies cost?
Well, the basic platform, meaning the basic unit, starts at $39,000. And then depending on how you outfit it from there, it could go all the way up to $90,000 or $100,000, depending on how medically intense that you need it. And, of course, the more medically intense that it is, the more expensive that it is. But the basic unit would be about $40,000.
And real quickly, the cottage could also be used for anybody with a disability, right?
Right. It isn't just for us as we age, but anybody with a disability, it would be very suitable for people that are impaired as far as walking and those kinds of things. There's a unit that you can have pressurized, so if people had compromised immune systems or if they've been burned or those kind of things, so that it's a sterile environment. There's a lot of different outfittings that you can have done to it.
How are sales? Are these popular?
We had, of course, in November, the CBS did a report and Fox did, and Washington Post, and from that, those three things, we probably have more than 4,000 inquiries that we are meticulously working through with our very small staff now.
Wow. Well, Ken Dupin, CEO of MedCottage, thanks so much for shooting the breeze with the two Boomer Babes.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much to all you at home for joining the two Boomer Babes. Hope to see you next week, same time, same station.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Any time of the year is a great time to bake a batch of cookies, especially if Kathy is doing the baking. But there's nothing like a fresh hot cookie right from the oven with a glass of milk to make us babes happy campers.
King Arthur is America's oldest flour company and the largest educator of home bakers in the world. And their latest cookbook, King Arthur Flour Cookie Companion, has hit the shelves and it's a whopper. Joining us to shoot the breeze and offer the best and the latest baking tips and even some advice for gluten-free recipes is Susan Reed, King Arthur's editor of their award-winning newsletter, The Baking Sheet. She joins us, and welcome to the show, Susan.
Thank you so much.
Susan, you actually began as a recipe tester, we understand, for King Arthur.
I
mean, what a fun job. What did you do, just like bake and eat all day long?
Well,
I want to apply.
I tend not to eat everything, but I was hired to test the recipes for the Baker's Companion, our very first big, our second big cookbook. It was a great job. Oh. I mean, I got to see what recipes worked and what didn't.
Oh, that's neat. Well, next time you need, you know, samplers, just come our way, okay? We'll be happy to do it. Now, I'm going to ask you something from a personal baking, you know, dilemma that I always have. I love to make chocolate chip cookies. Sometimes, but they're just, I never get them right. They're either flat or they're puffy. I mean, it's just, it's really frustrating. So what is the trick? I mean, I'm sure it's not your flour. I know it's me.
Well, measuring properly is important as far as if you have a scale, that's always more accurate. But otherwise, if you want to measure flour, you want to fluff it into, you know, stir it up, put it in a flat top measuring cup and then sweep it off the top. Don't want to dig into it and compact it. Usually if a cookie is flat, it means it might have too little flour. The traditional Toll House cookie recipe comes out really flat and crispy. That's just the way that that recipe is. I often make that recipe with another quarter cup of flour in it.
Oh, okay.
Well, if I baked, I'm sure my cookies would turn out perfect.
I'm sure they would be,
except
Barbara.
The problem is, Susan, I don't really bake. But I love to eat. So if I were to go all out and I was really trying to impress people and bake some bars for dessert for people,
yep,
can you give me an absolute no-fail recipe?
Do you have a mixer?
No.
Oh.
Well, kind of. I have a spoon that goes real fast.
She is her husband.
I do, actually, but like a hand mixer.
Yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a little ambitious, but it's also actually very easy. There is a recipe in here called Swedish Brownies that is one of the coolest recipes ever. And basically all you have to do is, with your hand mixer, beat together some eggs and sugar. But you have to do it for a pretty long time. And the coolest things happen to that mixture. It turns color, it gets all light and foamy, and it has a little bit of almond extract in it, but they're moist and they're dense and they're really fancy, and there's a million different ways that you can dress them up.
Ooh, can you
throw
a few chocolate chips in there too?
You could. I took that base recipe and I did all different kinds of riffs on it. I made like a double shot espresso bar. There's just lots of very cool.
Ooh, I can see Barbara's going to be very busy over the weekend.
Absolutely. I've cleared my schedule for Saturday.
Right, for Swedish brownies. That'll go with a massage. So, Susan, I got to ask you about this gluten-free.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, this is such a big thing these days. But, honestly, we have tried tasting these cookies and sweets, and they're really pretty awful, the ones that I've had.
Yeah.
What is there a good gluten-free recipe? I mean, actually, is there such a thing as gluten delicious?
There can be. I mean, certain traditional cookie recipes have always been gluten-free. I mean, they're good just by themselves. So there are some chocolate cookie recipes that I think there's a fudge drop recipe in here that is it never had gluten. There's enough structure from the cocoa powder that's in the cookie that it's just, you know, cocoa, sugar, eggs, and some vanilla, and it's really good. The almond cloud cookies, they're also very good. That's something that we sell in the bakery and have for years, and they're just excellent. It's like it's a macaron. And the third key to a decent gluten-free cookie is you really need whatever flour blend you're substituting for the wheat flour. You need something that's really good. You need a good quality of brown rice flour, which has to be ground very, very finely as part of that mixture. Some people use there's combinations of other things besides wheat flour that you have to put together to imitate the behavior of wheat flour. So we have a flour blend that we worked on for years in the test kitchen that we're pretty happy with, and it does a pretty good job. A lot of people wouldn't know.
Well, that sounds good.
Sounds like cookies you make, and I'm Jewish, and it sounds like cookies for Passover.
Yeah, there are some similarities there, yes.
Yeah,
definitely.
I'm thinking I can do this.
You can, yeah. Barbara.
Hey, it's coming up in
You're
March.
In charge of the
April.
Gluten-free cookies.
Absolutely. Well, Susan Reed, recipe tester and editor for King Arthur's Flour Company, thanks so much for shooting the breeze with the babes.
Oh, I'm so happy to have met you.
And now it's time for us babes to give credit where credit is due.
Audio and technical guru Julio Gonzalez, who magically pulls it all together.
Webmaster wizard Gail Jane, who makes TwoBoomerBabes.com a fab place to visit.
Founding members of the Chicago chapter of the Two Boomer Babes Supper Club, Mike and Larry Israel, for your unfailing love and support.
our husbands, daughters, family, and friends, even with smirks and eye rolls, who encourage us all the way
and give us great material, often without knowing it.
Our moms and upstairs directors, Jane and Sally, who are cheering us on from their bridge game in the sky.
Our home away from home, Delmarva Public Radio. And to you, our listeners, for joining us each week and spurring us on.
Two Boomer Babes is a production of Two Boomer Babes Media in collaboration with Zimer Communications.